Your house gets lots of visitors you never know about. This is not a security concern because they're not big enough to cart away your stuff. You've heard some of this before, all the bugs and bacteria and other critters that hide in the nooks and crannies of your home. Our guest this hour studies them, in fact, studies the home as an ecosystem, and he shares some of the results of his work in a book called Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live. Rob Dunn is the author. He lives in Raleigh, where he's a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State. He's also attached to the Natural History Museum of Denmark at the University of Copenhagen. Rob's written five other books. Hi, Rob.
Hey, great to be on the show, Jeff.
Good to have you. Your first paragraph sounds great. You grew up outdoors, and then you remind us that that's actually a rare upbringing these days.
Yeah, it is. I mean, so the average kid today spends something like 23 and a half hours out of 24 indoors or in cars, and it's really been a radical shift in what we're exposed to.
Now, this I didn't know. It's not just Americans, though.
No, I mean, it's true across Europe, and it, you know, varies from country to country and culture to culture, but it's a general move, and we're moving towards cities, and in cities we move indoors, and then we sort of forget that that's unusual, and so it comes pretty easily to us.
It's a name you give to this species we're developing here, Homo indoorus. So you're facetious about that, I think.
Yeah, but it is I am facetious about that, but it is a new phase in our story, right? That there's not much precedent in mammals in general for a species that spends most of its time isolated from the rest of biodiversity, and we've not spent that much time thinking about what the consequences of that move are.
And it's interesting that as we have moved indoors, you have taken your studies there as well. You've essentially, it looks like, studied the indoors as an ecosystem.
Yeah, so I actually started as a tropical ecologist, and so I worked on, you know, what lives in the soil and in rainforest canopies, and, you know, spent the early part of my career just fascinated by the fact that every time you turned over a new leaf or a log, there was something new. And as I moved to living in a city and then working with people in that city, it became more and more clear that many of the kinds of things that we were finding in rainforests that you could also find in homes. And then the idea that we hadn't figured out everything we could figure out about the places that we wake up every morning, it just sort of stuck in my craw, and it was impossible not to study this life. And it turns out to be pretty fun.
I can't imagine the diversity is as rich as the rainforest, but you're the guy who studied this. I mean, is there that much diversity inside the walls of our homes?
So it's very much not as diverse as the rainforest, but it's much more diverse than we tend to think it is. And so... You know, we found tens of thousands of kinds of bacteria in houses, tens of thousands of kinds of fungi. We studied 50 houses in Raleigh, and in those 50 houses, we found more than 1,000 kinds of insects and their relatives. And so all of that is paltry compared to what you'd find in, you know, one forest in Bolivia. And yet, I think it's much, much more than we tend to imagine when we wake up and inhale.
No doubt, and as you point out, that we breathe it in, we eat it, you know, it's basically moving in and out of our bodies all the time, which raises the question, how often do people run screaming out of your lectures and presentations?
Every so often.
As you point out, they might want to...
Usually I can see it on their face before they leave, but yeah.
As you point out, they might want to go home and scrub the living daylights out of their houses, but you say that's a bad idea. Why?
Well, I mean, so we need to keep using the standard sort of hygiene that we figured out 150 years ago works. And so keep washing our hands with soap and water. We need water supplies that are free of pathogens to keep ourselves safe from fecal-oral pathogens. We need to vaccinate ourselves. But what we don't need is this sort of all-out war on the life around us, which seems to have gotten more and more complete as the years have gone by. Because the truth is, the proportion of the species that are in your house that are dangerous is teeny. And when we go to war with everything, we risk getting rid of the stuff that benefits us and in the end, not actually getting rid of the stuff that's harmful. And so I think we need a little bit of moderation as we confront our bedrooms, bathrooms, and beyond.
Almost a plug for a business there. This almost ends up, Rob, sounding like gut bacteria in this sense that, you know, it might weird you out at first to realize you have all these things living inside of you, but you need them to live. I mean, is it kind of like that with our houses too?
Yeah, it's very much like that. And I think the way to think about it is that your body, your existence doesn't end at the what you see. And in the same way that that's true for gut bacteria, it's true for skin bacteria, it's true for what you're breathing in, it's true for your relationship between your immune system and what's around you. And so we need to recognize that there's all this life around us, and there's going to be life regardless, and the only thing we can control is some measure of which life it is. And so it behooves us to get rid of the really bad stuff, but also to figure out, you know, these things that help make us healthy, how do we make sure that they stay around? And the first task in keeping them around is just to figure out what they are. And a big part of what we've done is really just to start to catalog, well, who is in your house? And who might have been in houses historically that's no longer in a house in Oregon or New York? And it seems like something we might have done 200 years ago, but we really didn't. And so we're sort of at the beginning of the story.
Have we cataloged all the bacteria yet? Are we even close, you think?
No, we're not even close. I mean, so there was a paper a couple of years ago that argued that there are trillions of species of bacteria. And I think most microbiologists think that's too many. But we don't know well enough to argue really firmly against it. And so it's just a measure of our broad-scale ignorance that we can't totally rule out that trillions number. It's probably too many. But certainly most species of bacteria around us every day are not yet named. We don't know how to grow them. We don't know what they eat. We don't know what they do. And you're inhaling those right now.
Okay, I will use this breath to let people know that we are going to take a break right now and return and talk more with Rob Dunn, an ecologist at North Carolina State University. His book is called Never Home Alone. We'll talk about the things living in your house and how they can be good for you when we return to The Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Rob Dunn, who works as a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University. He studies the indoors as an ecosystem. And boy, we got a lot of stuff living in our houses that might surprise you. And Rob gives us a pretty good sketch of all that in his book, Never Home Alone. From microbes to millipedes, camel crickets, and honeybees, the natural history of where we live. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Questions and comments about what's in your house, 800-838-3760. Okay, maybe not your house specifically, but our houses collectively. 800-838-3760. Emails to jx@jeffnet.org. The book is illustrated, I should point out, and even the first one provides kind of a whoa. I never even thought about the fact that with all that vertical living space, that New York City's indoor space is much greater than its outdoor land area.
Yeah, that's a crazy reality of our cities now, and you know, it's interesting in and of itself. But if you think about the habitat that organisms have to adapt to and move into, and the resources available to them, it means that, for example, in Manhattan, you know, that there's more space and more food available to a species that can move indoors than one that lives outdoors. And so, if we think about the future of evolution, even. A lot of that future evolution is going to happen right where we are. And so we need to be aware of what we're providing.
Wow, I hadn't thought about that. But there's that much more habitat indoors, then that's logically where things are going to happen to the creatures that live there. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a whole, you know, I think we spend a lot of time as ecologists and evolutionary biologists going to faraway places to study ecology and evolution. And all the main things we could study in the Galapagos are happening in apartments and in, all the places we live.
So that's the macro. Let's go to the micro and right to the microscope guy that we all learned about in elementary school, Anthony van Leeuwenhoek, the Dutch guy. Why was he looking at peppercorns in his microscope?
Well, he was an amateur biologist in general, and he became fascinated with the microscope. And he was surrounded mostly by painters rather than by other biologists, and it was a time when painting had sort of turned itself on the indoors, on interiors. And so perhaps inspired by them, he was looking indoors. But he originally looked at pepper because he wanted to figure out why pepper was spicy. And so he imagined that if he looked at pepper grains, he would see, you know, little teeny spikes that were hitting his tongue. And instead, he took some pepper and put it in water and looked at it. And he saw teeny tiny life forms, and these were actually the first bacteria ever to be seen in his kitchen, in his pepper, And so microbiology was born indoors.
Oh, okay. So here we go. Right at the beginning of the science, it was there inside of doors. How did scientists at the time respond, Rob?
Well, it's interesting. So Leeuwenhoek himself responded by spending the next 40, 50 years studying everything he could find. And so that was, you know, cheese, vinegar, his own sperm, his friend's sperm. He just looked at anything. But for the most part, other scientists didn't follow up on what he did. He was kind of left on his own to document this microscopic world. And then he died, and there was a kind of quiet period for microbiology. And then as microbiology emerges anew, at that point, microbiologists had discovered germ theory. They discovered that some of these species could kill us. And so all of that wonder he had for the things around him suddenly started to disappear as we were confronted with the fact that in among these little growing things were dangerous ones.
So here's a great place to stop for a moment, because of all the bacteria that we know of, how many species can actually cause us harm?
There are about 50 species that commonly cause us harm. And so 50 out of a million, 50 out of trillions, whatever your accounting is of the total number, it means the vast, vast, vast majority are either benign or beneficial. And so when we go to war with bacteria, we're really going to war with all of those species quite accidentally and hurting the good ones along with the bad ones.
So that was the part that really got me going at the beginning of the book is that just 50 species of bacteria can harm us out of all the ones that we know about. Our guest is Rob Dunn here on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Never Home Alone. The book then takes us to Iceland and hot springs and bacteria living there. What do they teach us?
Well, so Thomas Brock was a microbiologist who discovered many interesting things, and he did it in part, or continues to do it, by studying really extreme places in which microbes could live there. And so he went to a hot spring in Yellowstone and one in Iceland, and he looked at what was living in hot springs, and he thought in these really hot conditions he saw life. And so he brought samples back to the lab, and he couldn't grow life initially, but then he kept the samples at temperatures close to boiling. And what he found was that there were microbes that would only grow at those really hot temperatures. And so not only do they grow at hot temperatures, they require them. And so it was this whole new way of seeing life. And then those microbes would go on to be used in basically all DNA work we do today, because the enzymes that they have for being able to live at high temperatures are the same enzymes we use to make copies of DNA. And so if you think about every crime scene show you've ever seen where they have to use DNA evidence, they're using enzymes from those microbes or microbes like them. But that wouldn't be in a book about houses at all, except that Thomas Brock then went back to the lab and via a few twists and turns found that those same microbes live in hot water heaters in our houses. And so this thing that he went to the sort of literal edges of the earth to find was all the time living in his own house in his hot water heater. Yeah, just sort of chilling out and going through the pipes every so often when he turned on the right spigot.
Literally chilling out. I mean, the fact is that most of the temperatures that we can stand are too cold for them. But so if we got bacteria in our water heaters, is it benign or beneficial?
Totally benign. We don't know how they get there. We know a little bit about their metabolism. But even though they seem to be very, very widespread, there's only one graduate student actively studying them in the world that I know of, and she's actually moved on to a new job, and so she's kind of done studying them. And so here's this thing we know is in water heaters. We know it's interesting. We know it must have some intriguing history. And, you know, right now it's just left there. It's hanging out. And so I think they're kind of emblematic of what we know and don't know more generally, that if you pick a little habitat in your home, the odds are you'll find species no one's studying, even though they might be very intriguing.
So, Rob, does it surprise even you that you ended up really focusing on indoor ecosystems? Because you described, for example, your exploits in Costa Rica at age 20, you know, whacking the jungle with a machete. So it sounds like you really enjoy the outdoors yourself. But for that reason, is it surprising to you that you've spent so much time focusing on indoor ecosystems?
It is surprising, but I guess what's happened is we keep finding new things indoors, like totally new observations or species, and then those lead us to other questions. And so every time we go back outdoors, some totally new phenomenon shows up, and you know, it's hard not to study it.
So when you started down this, go ahead.
Oh no, go ahead.
So when you started down this path, I mean, was there anybody really studying the indoors as an ecosystem as you have done?
Yeah, so the Sloan Foundation funded a group of researchers to start to study what they called the built environment, and so homes, and about a decade ago. And so that jump started some work in homes. And so I would say that about the time we started to study homes, that a handful of people around the world had sort of returned to think about them anew. But there'd not been much work between then and sort of, Leeuwenhoek, in part because the work that was being done was really focused on the species we thought of as dangerous or really problematic. And so, you know, if we knew that the species was one of those 50 that was dangerous, we know a lot about it. But if it wasn't one of those 50, it wasn't really in front of everyone. And if you were trained like me as an ecologist and somebody said, well, you can go study competition among microbes, you would typically be encouraged to go off to a rainforest or to a deep sea vent or somewhere like that. And so we kind of left the daily environment, especially the wondrous parts of it, unexplored.
So through the studies, is the list of what we know to live with us indoors much longer now?
Yeah, I mean, every time somebody studies a house, that list grows. And so just as an example, we studied the insects and other arthropods in 50 houses with Michelle Trotwine at the Cal Academy and Matt Bertone here at NC State. And in that first study, we found 1,000 or so species in those houses. But we've since started a project on the iNaturalist platform where people can take pictures of insects and their relatives in their houses around the world. And so we can see not only the houses that we go into, but houses more generally. And as people have started to do that, we've seen things in houses that we never imagined were in houses. And so, for example, in tropical Asia, there's a set of these giant crab spiders that are like the size of a starfish that are really common in houses. And obviously, if you have a spider the size of a starfish in your house, you know it. but scientifically, that's not really part of our understanding of what's going on in homes. And so, you know, it's new to the scientific literature, the reality that those spiders are so common. And so every time somebody shines a light in their home, we seem to find new things. And the more global those lights become, the more unusual those things potentially become. And so another example, people have started taking pictures of their arthropods in their homes in New Zealand. And if you would have asked me what's in houses in New Zealand, I would have said, well, a bunch of British stuff that moved with the colonists. And instead, there are a bunch of endemic house spiders only found in New Zealand that are common in houses. And they're even different from the North Island to the South Island. And so tons of surprises, and that will keep being the case.
Truly. And we have talked to Michelle Trotwine, too, about the arthropods and also about face mites, I think, was the last time we had her on from the Cal Academy of Sciences. So all kinds of interesting critters there. We're learning a lot this morning from Rob Dunn, who works in the ecology department at the North Carolina State University. And his book is called Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live. This is a discussion you're welcome to join with questions or comments about things that may be lurking inside your own home and how good they can actually be for you versus how bad. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email from Larry in Arcata who wants to know, what critters grow in mattresses? Can they be controlled by keeping a mattress drier? Which are bad for your health? Thanks for your input, says Larry in Arcata.
That's a great question, Larry. So our mattresses, I mean, there are a bunch of places that we put our bodies in our houses, and those tend to accumulate things that live off of us. We're kind of the base of the food web in our bed. And so there's some great early studies of what lives in mattresses. And so we know that your skin accumulates in the mattress, and then bacteria and fungi grow on your skin, and then dust mites eat the skin and the bacteria and the fungi, and then there are slightly larger leopard mites that eat the dust mites, and so it's really a whole food web in there. But if you keep the bed dry or if you keep it sealed, that food web's a little less abundant. And if you're not allergic, all of that life is not doing you any harm. If you're allergic to dust mites, obviously it causes you problems and you want to find a way to seal the mattress.
I think you use the term snowflakes in the book, which you know, gives an impression that there's sort of this constant churn of stuff in the air around us that comes from us.
Yeah, we're kind of like Pigpen from the the Charlie Brown character, that everywhere we go, we sort of shed bits and pieces of ourselves. And I think one of the interesting things is that, you know, that's always true. No matter how much you clean, you're shedding yourself. But the more we seal ourselves indoors, the more that's the dominant thing in our apartments and homes. And so I think one of the really simple things people can do is just open their windows a little bit more. And it lets in some of those outdoor microbes to compete with and even eat that stuff that's falling off of you. Because that will always be there. Your snowflakes fall in such great density that you won't preclude that reality.
You know, I notice as I walk around my own neighborhood that even on days when the air is pleasant and clear, that I don't see a lot of open windows. So this seems to be a fairly typical way to keep a home in today's world.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, and one of the interesting sort of data points for us in that regard is that Jenna Lang at UC Davis did a study where she took our same approach for swabbing houses, and she had the astronaut swab the space station. And the space station is sort of like the ultimate in keeping the windows closed, right? That it's what you get if you scrub everything all the time and you keep the windows closed and there are no other exposures. And what the space station basically looks like is like some mix of skin microbes, toilet seat, pillowcase, but with really very little else. And that's what happens if you keep the windows closed all the time, if you keep yourself really sealed off, is that those end up being the only exposures that you have. And we don't know exactly what that does, but it's hard to imagine that that's what we desire.
Well, I got curious when I was reading this portion of the book, though, to ask if you were in charge of the International Space Station, what might you do to balance the bacterial load?
Well, I mean, I think they're sort of they're stuck in the world that they've made there. But it should give us pause about imagining our future worlds. You know, I think if we imagine when I was a kid, we watched the Jetsons, and if you look at the Jetsons world, it's a world totally separated from the out of doors. Like life does not come in, and so I think hard to reimagine the space station. But it for sure is true that as we think about our own homes in the future, we do get to imagine different scenarios. And so we could imagine little gardens in our houses where we garden microbes that we know are beneficial. At the same time, you know, that's kind of what we do in our kitchens. When you make a sourdough starter, you're essentially gardening some microbes that you know aren't doing us harm and seem to benefit us. And so I think we could imagine in the future each room would have its own garden beneficial microbes that help to keep us well and fend off the bad stuff. But that's a ways off.
Well, so while we're talking about homes of the future, let's talk about homes of the past, because you give a great history lesson here, too, that proto-humans were making structures up to 300,000 years ago, more regularly 20,000 years ago. So at that time, certainly not much barrier between inside and out. We talked about how tightly sealed our quarters are today with not much outside in there. And then you also go on to talk about the sampling of sleeping quarters of other animals that are close to us genetically. Chimpanzees, for example. I mean, what are in a chimpanzee's sleeping quarters that we don't have?
Yeah, Megan Temis led this great study where she looked at chimp nests. And chimp nests are kind of like beds. They use them for one night. They sleep in them. Their body's in contact with them. And when Megan did that study, I had no idea what she would find. And so you might imagine that they would be like our beds, like Larry, the caller, asked, you know, that there would be chimp dust mites and chimp leopard mites and the like. And what Megan found was, in fact, the opposite, which was that the chimp beds had almost no evidence of the chimps, that there were very, very, very few chimp-associated microbes. And they were mostly totally dominated by leaf microbes and stick microbes and soil microbes. And so I think that it's reasonable to imagine that for most of our evolutionary history, that's mostly what we were exposed to. That sure, our snowflake of cells were flaking off of skin, but the exposure was actually dominated by a wilderness of things. And so I think it's really fascinating to contemplate that.
Really, all the things that we left outside and have excluded from our homes now. The book is called Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets, and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live. We have more time coming up with Rob Dunn, and you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone or email when we return to talk more about Never Home Alone in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Rob Dunn, a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University. He is also attached to the Natural History Museum of Denmark at the University of Copenhagen, and he's written a book about the things that live in our houses with us, and I do not mean dogs, cats, parrots, fish, anything like that. It's called Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets, and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live. You can join the conversation on the exchange and ask questions about what might be in our homes and what good is it doing us. The answer is not enough, because there's not enough from the outside in there, we've learned so far. You can join us at 800-838-3760, or you can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I don't know why, Rob. I love stories of epidemiology and people who figured out what were making people sick. Dr. John Snow and his heroic work on a cholera outbreak in London. What did he do?
Well, so Snow basically figured out that you could make sense of who was getting cholera if you understood where the water was coming from. And he did this through a series of studies and observations of people getting sick and not getting sick. And in one neighborhood in Soho, he was able to show that all the people who were getting sick seemed to be getting water from a single well. And that well would turn out to be contaminated. And years later, it would be realized it was contaminated with the bacteria that causes cholera. And so it then suggested a way to keep people healthy by making sure that water supplies weren't contaminated with species that were harmful. But the other piece of that story that's interesting is that he partially understood what was going on by mapping it, but then he also showed it to people by presenting the map, by saying that, offering the map as kind of evidence of what might be happening.
Now, it was a presence that caused that outbreak. It turns out there was a diaper in an abandoned well, which I just, that is fascinating, that it actually had a point source like that. But you shift our focus at this point in the book away from presence to absence. So it's actually that we lack things indoors is really the issue.
Yes. So I think it's important to recognize that we can be sick both because something's there and when something's not there. And, you know, the 200 years of epidemiology and public health have showed us the many important ways to control the things we don't want to be there, like cholera. But in the process, we miss the reality that it seems as though we can also get sick when things are absent. Now, the trick with figuring out how the absence of species makes us sick is that you can study one species, you know, that's present and how it makes you sick, but absence is much more complex because many, many species, and the mix of many species might be the absence that's causing problems. And so it becomes a really gnarly challenge.
All right, so it's not that you're missing just this, but you're missing this and this and this that share an ecosystem with it. So it sounds like we're not really sure about what we need from outdoor exposure, or do we?
That's right. I mean, I think that a number of scientists feel relatively sure that they've figured out what we're missing, but we're at the moment in the story when scientists disagree about which feature is key. But I think that there's a growing consensus that the failure to be exposed to a diversity of microbes is associated with a whole suite of allergies and autoimmune disorders, that some aspect of something we're missing. And there are a number of studies that provide, I think, useful anecdotes here. And so in the book, I talk about a study in Finland where a group looked at teenagers in houses that were basically the same, socioeconomically very similar, but the houses differed in the biodiversity of plants in the backyard. And those studies were able to show that the teens with more native plant biodiversity, more kinds of native plants, had different microbes on their skin and more diverse microbes on their skin and were at a reduced risk of allergy. And so we're starting to see a number of studies like that where you see this link between a biodiversity of exposures. We get exposed to a bunch of things and health and well-being, but then figuring out exactly which pieces. And the pieces might be different in Finland from what they are in Cleveland. Or another recent study compared Amish and Hutterite populations. And so these are genetically very similar groups, both moved from Germany, living relatively similar lifestyles. But we know that the Amish have very low rates of allergy and asthma, and the Hutterites have actually quite high rates of allergy and asthma. And so the hypothesis has been that the Hutterites are being exposed to something different from the Amish, and that particularly they're not being exposed to key microbes. And a recent series of studies at the University of Chicago has actually done really neat work here, and has actually been able to show if you take dust from Hutterite houses, where kids are mostly not being exposed to that much biodiversity, the animals aren't very close to the house, agricultural is industrialized, and you give it to allergic mice, that those mice basically, all their allergy and asthma symptoms are there and don't go away. But if you take the Amish dust that has lots of microbes from animals, microbes from plants, microbes of many diverse sources, and give it to the mice, the symptoms of those mice are partially fixed. And so we see these kinds of anecdotes that are hinting at this key role of biodiversity, but we're still not at the stage where we understand exactly what's going on.
But it sounds like the only real difference, the Amish and Hutterites are both, they don't use a lot of modern technology, but the real difference was that in one case, their front doors are that much closer to the barn? Is that what it ultimately came down to?
Yeah, that's what it looks like. So and the Hutterite farms are more industrialized, so the barn's far away, the animals are far away, versus in the Amish case, the animals are you know, they spend a fair amount of time pretty close to the house. And so if you imagine the windows open, kids are going in and out, the odds of being exposed to all those microbes coming from the animals, coming to from the plants, is just higher. And so, you know, this is as clean an example from the real world as we can hope to find, where you've sort of held most things constant, but this and a couple other minor features of daily life are different. And so this isn't the nail in the coffin in terms of our understanding, but it's pretty intriguing.
It is indeed. Let's zoom all the way in, though. Explain, if you would, Rob, gamma proteobacteria and what we get from it.
Well, so this is a group of bacteria that the Finnish researchers in particular argue are really key to helping our immune systems to function properly. And so the Finnish group has actually shown that the people who have more exposure to biodiversity are more likely to be exposed to these bacteria and are less likely to have allergy and asthma. And they've also shown in a mouse model that you can give mice exposures to these bacteria and they're less likely to develop allergy and asthma. And so they've argued that it's these bacteria in particular that seem to be key. Now, it may be that those bacteria are key. It may also be that if you're exposed to those bacteria, the odds you're also being exposed to some other key bacteria is also going up. We're not sure yet, but even before we're totally sure, the fact that they can potentially be used therapeutically suggests, well, maybe someday we can figure out just which of these bacteria we need and make sure we get exposed to them. But that day is not yet.
No. So, but where we are now, then, you were talking about potentially having little gardens in each room in the house. I mean, is it better if we had gardens outside of our houses and spent some time in there? I mean, do we actually have to spend time with our hands in the dirt to get some of the benefits? Do we know that even yet?
Yeah. So I mean, I think that there are a bunch of things that we can do that we know are not harmful and that are potentially beneficial, that are probably the easiest interventions today. So open your windows, get your hands in the dirt, garden, be exposed to plants outdoors. doesn't seem to hurt to get a dog. These are all things that, you know, we might enjoy for other reasons, and these potentially reduce our risk of some of these autoimmune and allergic disorders. And so I think that's probably, you know, the best course of action we can take today. There's actually a Finnish project to try to add biodiversity to people's backyards to see experimentally over the long term, can they reduce allergy and asthma in Finnish neighborhoods? And so it'll be interesting to see what emerges there, because it's one of the first real interventions. And it's a low-risk one, because there aren't really big risks of adding a garden to your life. And so I think it's an easy step given what we know now.
We have some questions about other steps that some listeners have contributed. Before we get to those, I do want to acknowledge camel crickets and why they get their own chapter in the book.
Yeah, so camel crickets are one of the... there are these relatively large cave crickets that get in the houses. We've known they've been in houses for a long time. And so we had a postdoctoral researcher, MJ Epps, who decided that she wanted to study, you know, how common are they really in houses. And so she asked people to say if they had them. And so 500 people or so responded that they had or didn't have them. And what quickly emerged is that where people said they had camel crickets in their house was wrong relative to what we knew from the literature. And so MJ then asked people to send in pictures, and what emerged was that what we were looking for was largely absent, which are these relatively small native camel crickets. But what was in houses was a large Japanese camel cricket that was known to be present in the U.S. but not known to be common in houses. And so this for me was amazing, because basically we discovered this relatively giant cricket in houses that had been totally overlooked. And so... If we can find a giant cricket in houses that's been overlooked, what else is in there?
Oh, boy. It's just sort of like, you know, rediscovering our inner space here instead of discovering outer space. All right. So some questions from listeners. Liz, we already talked about allergies. Somebody else wants to know about whether we need alcohol wipes for high exposure areas. I mean, you know, as much as we want to get more microbes, should we be careful about doing things like wiping down the shopping cart handle, stuff like that?
You know, so for the most part, most of the evidence suggests that if you wash your hands with soap and water, especially after you think you might have, you know, a higher risk of exposure to fecal oral pathogens, that provides all of the benefit that you need. That soap and water doesn't work less well than do antimicrobial wipes or alcohol, and it's been working for a long time. And so... For the most part, keep using soap and water, and that works. Now, that changes a little bit if you have autoimmune problems or if you're immunocompromised, and there it's trickier and the answers are a little harder. But what we're also seeing is that antimicrobial wipes, which the listener asked about alcohol, which seems to be more or less okay, although we don't really know super well what the long-term consequences of using it on your hands are. But the antimicrobial wipes are a definite no-no in most cases, because they actually appear to be favoring a subset of microbes that's able to live on the antimicrobial wipes. And so they are indeed killing, like, the flu virus when it lands on your hand, but they're also potentially killing some of the stuff you want on your hands. And so, go back to soap and water. And what soap and water is doing is it's the most recently arrived things on your hands that haven't really established yet, it's helping to get rid of them. And so I think that's a key lesson. And the other would be a lot of these places you often see studies that, shopping carts, the dirtiest thing in the world, and your cell phones, the dirtiest thing in the world. The fact that we're human and we live in high densities, our microbes are everywhere, and you just have to sort of make yourself comfortable with that reality. And in those chance places where you might be getting fecal microbes, make sure to wash your hands, think about what you're eating. But for the most part, you can relax a little bit. You know that we're microbial and that these things will be there and that's mostly okay.
And about a minute left for an answer to Peter and Ashlyn's question about HVAC, about heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, and any concerns we should have about what they're spewing out, taking in, or redistributing in our houses.
Yeah, so the super short answer is that we know that HVACs are spreading some microbes. We don't know how good or bad that is, or what consequences it has over the long term. And so it's a real trick. I mean, if you smell an odor when you turn your HVAC on, it's typically one of those microbes kind of exhaling, and you're smelling it. It's a belch. And so some people have advocated that when you're turning your HVAC on initially, to open your windows a little bit to let it vent. I mean, we don't know if that helps or hurts. It seems like something we should know, and we just don't.
All right, but that's a big recommendation right there that you mentioned before, is open your windows once in a while.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, right now, if you're in California and everything's on fire, and the outdoors is a dangerous place in terms of toxins, obviously.
Right.
Pay attention to what you're letting in, but.
All right, so not in smoke season, but otherwise, for sure. Rob Dunn, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, he's a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State. His book is Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel, Crickets, and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live. Rob, thank you so much.